Final hour, Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Paul Kuharski, Ian Safar here with you on this Thursday morning. And as we do every Thursday morning at 8 o'clock, we head to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. And welcome in our friend Charles Robinson to the program from Yahoo Sports. Charles, good morning, brother. How are we doing?
What's going on, gents? How you doing this morning?
Doing great, man. Appreciate you taking time to be with us. Charles, there's a lot of places to go here. I don't really know where to start, so I guess I'll just start here. The Amari Demarcado situation, dropping the football in the Titans-Cardinals game this last week. You got Jonathan Gannon and the altercation on the sideline with him in the aftermath of that. The Cardinals fining him $100,000. I guess a couple things on this. Number one, how in the world do these NFL players keep dropping the football before they run into the end zone? That continues to just be a mystifying thing to me. And then what did you make of kind of the aftermath of that, from the Titans winning the game to the Jonathan Gannon situation and the blowback that's happened since then?
Yeah, the dropping the ball thing is just, I mean, it's wild to me. I mean, I was thinking about it, and I remember, I think the first time I ever saw anybody do it, I was watching the U.S. Army All-American game. I don't even remember what year it was, but I think I saw DeSean Jackson do it in that game. And I thought, that's got to be the dumbest thing I've ever seen anybody ever do. And I thought, I'll never see that again. And then the NFL, you know, obviously it's been delivered to us multiple times over Malachi Corley, obviously. You know, you've never scored a touchdown in the NFL because the one moment you had with the Jets last year, you drop it before you get over the goal line. And then obviously we see, you know, A.D. Mitchell and then Amari Demarcado and back-to-back weeks. It's inexplicable to me. And I've never seen, though, the destructive, I guess, power of it in a game where, as I'm watching the play unfold, and I'm pretty sure, I don't know if I was watching on Red Zone when it happened or if I had been watching the game live at that moment, but I remember just thinking, like, oh, that's it. They crushed him. It's over. You know, I think it texted you and Joe. And I was like, you know, in that moment, I think I'm like, okay, so this is like, is Callahan going to survive the night?
Right.
And then we just see everything completely shift and fall apart for the Cardinals. And I'll tell you what, I will say this. I spent time with Jonathan Gannon multiple times over the last couple of years. Extremely intense individual. And I knew in that moment, I was like, this could be something. Like this is, you know, knowing how he is and the intensity that he has, I was not surprised at all to see his reaction on the sidelines. And you know, the fine was appropriate. I think the fact that he came out the next day and, said he apologized to Demarcado, spoke to the team, apologized to the team, knew he had kind of done something in that moment that wasn't right. You kind of knew that this was going to go into territory where it could potentially be a fine. And, I just from texting to people with the union, you know, you can't – the contact between a coach and a player in that moment definitely crosses a line. And it was different than what we'd seen between, like, Travis Kelce and Andy Reid. I'm curious to see how this manifests for the Titans to get a win like that, because you're like, okay, you got to win. So it's a positive. But I mean, is it, you know, how do you carry that to the next week? It's not like a commanding win. It's not like, when you see a win and the win is played out the next day in memes where it's like Benny Hill music and showing everything wrong that the Cardinals did, you're kind of like, I don't know how much the other team could take from this. I guess you take them where you can ultimately get them. And I'm also curious to see how it, you know, what it does to the Cardinals as well, because it's a team that's got talent, but I mean, they're very limited in offense. And that can be a moment that, you know, your team spirals a little bit. And it's just, I'm very fascinated to see where it goes for both franchises.
I just hate that the guy that makes a stupid play ends up in a situation where he becomes the victim.
Sure.
And that becomes a story. We've got to blot out this from football. What do you make of the Cleveland's quarterback situation going forward now after the gigantic Joe Flacco trade? And part B of that is, what do you think the Bengals would get out of Joe Flacco?
Well, I tuned in to Kevin Stefanski yesterday because I was just like, I want to hear what this sounds like, because I just this is such a left turn from what you knew about the internal workings of the organization and what Stefanski wanted in terms of having a veteran in the number two quarterback spot. You know, like Dillon Gabriel, clearly when it comes to Stefanski, he's the chosen rookie between he and Shador in terms of who knows the offense, who can go out there and operate, and then structurally having a qualified veteran to be in that number two support role, who he trusts, who can operate the offense, and then going into a Sunday, you know, just having it set up the way he wanted. And so when Flacco got traded, I was like, I there's no way. I thought in my mind, I was like, there's no way Kevin could have been a part of this. There's just no way. And then listening to his press conference, clearly he wasn't. You know, he even though he said, like, you know, look, Andrew Berry and I, the general manager, we talk about these trades, we talk about things. But he kept, you know, he said a couple of times, he pointed really clearly at Berry and said, you know, I trust him. I trust his decisions. Okay, well, that's on Berry. This is 100% in Andrew Berry's lap. And I expect Bailey Zappe will end up being the number two quarterback, depending on, you know, if Kevin ultimately makes that decision completely on his own. I don't see any scenario where he wants a rookie backing up a rookie going into a Sunday, particularly a rookie in a support role in Shador, who does not have the grasp of the offense the way that Dillon Gabriel does. Just doesn't. It's nonsensical, I think, at this point to sort of pitch it that way moving forward. And you could see it, or you could hear it, you know, in Kevin in yesterday's press conference. And I'm like, man, this guy's trapped inside a nightmare right now. Like he's got to be freaking out because he's just, you know, lost control of exactly how he wanted the quarterback room set up. And you've done it just to swap a draft pick now. And clearly the you know, Cleveland Browns are open for business. You've seen the trades, you know, Greg Newsome is someone that, when the Lions had Terrion Arnold go down, I was texting with guys around the league, and they're like, hey, man, I bet you they make a call to the Cleveland Browns about Greg Newsome. And you know, Arnold, the news came back a little better than the Lions thought. I think that removed some of the inclination to make a, you know, quickly move out there to get a corner. But, you know, see the Jaguars make that move. Tyson Campbell, obviously, it's not working out there the way that they had imagined. So they get two guys a fresh start. But, yeah, the Browns are this is a heck of a mess. And I think, you know, it's we'll see what happens with Gabriel for the rest of the season now. But the nightmare that they could have invented by drafting Shador in the fifth round after taking Gabriel in the third, they're experiencing it right now. And that hive, by the way,
nailed it.
It's I will say, you know, of all the years I've covered things, I said something I ripped Shador for miming, you know, pantomiming things when Dillon Gabriel got the job. I ripped ESPN for being this echo chamber of this, you know, ESPN employee says this about him, and then it gets played on this show, and then this show comes up with a new opinion, and then a new opinion, and the next thing you know, you got Adam Schefter out here trying to explain why Shador is pantomiming based on something Rex Ryan said. And I kind of ripped ESPN. I said, and by the way, I said, look, we at Yahoo are part of the problem too. We've played into this. We've leaned into this. We've written Shador a million times, talked to, you know, about Shador ad nauseum. But, you know, it's ridiculous how this is elevated into this cult status. Man, did the hive go crazy. I mean, it was just, I literally thought, I'm not even kidding, by the end of the day, once our social media team had cut up the podcast that day, by the end of the day, I thought I was going to get doxxed. I'm not even kidding. I was like, man, I'm going to at some point, photos are going up of my house. Like they're going to, like, I'm going to get doxxed. And I have not seen anything like that other than, you know, I think about Tebow, and I think we've talked about this in the past, just about how, the hive around a player, a certain individual, is just so intense. And it is that way for Shador. And I'm curious to see how the Browns outlive it, because there's no question when you talk to people in the organization who knows that offense better and who they feel more comfortable with between the two rookies, you know, operating it. And it's Dylan Gabriel, and that's something that's not going to go away through the end of the season. So,
yeah, no doubt about that. So another bizarre situation this weekend, Charles, the Mark Sanchez stuff in Indianapolis. So he's felony battery charges for the altercation with the 69-year-old delivery driver. What do you make of this? How does Fox handle this from here? Where do you see this going? What do you make of what a crazy story this weekend in Indianapolis?
I was stunned. I couldn't believe it. Like I didn't initially see the news. Dawn saw it, and she said, "Hey, Mark Sanchez got stabbed." And I was like, "The Mark Sanchez?" I was like, "Just from the Mark Sanchez, the analyst, like, you know, former Jet Mark Sanchez." She's like, "Yeah, he got stabbed in Indianapolis, downtown Indianapolis." And I thought to myself, I'm like, I've been in downtown Indianapolis, you know, a couple of weeks out of the year for 20 years, you know, right. Like I've seen some crazy stuff. I don't think people would remember this, but there was actually someone shot and killed in their car in downtown Indianapolis last couple of years, where the vehicle kind of came to a rolling stop in the middle of downtown Indianapolis, and it kind of been something that transpired between two cars. And, you know, but I just was like, wow, this is nuts. And read it initially and kind of, you know, everyone's concerned about Mark, and then to see it flip the way that it did was, that was really stunning. And I thought, okay, well, so for the narrative to go the way that it has from authorities, you know, to get to the point where he's in the hospital and you're charging him in the hospital. And then to get to the point where he's checking out of the hospital, you're taking him to jail, and yep. Now it's become a felony issue. The first thing I thought in my mind is, man, this must be some crystal clear footage. Like, there must be something that they have in their hands that shows there's no doubt in their minds to move the way that they did, and to have the guy who, you know, stabbed him now portrayed as the victim. And then to see the photos, I was like, it's unlike anything I've ever seen. I mean, sometimes things surprise you and you're like, I never could have, you know, predicted something like this. I don't know what to really say about it, because we're going to kind of watch this now unfold legally. And, you know, it's not like this is a guy in a small job, right? I mean, it's a massive job. So there's, a massive spotlight, and, it's one of those things that comes out of left field, and I just don't even know what to really say about it. It's funny, because we talked about it in the podcast, Andrew Siciliano and I was like, you know, how we, what do we even say?
Yeah.
Like, it's so crazy that I don't even, you know, what do we say other than, you know, if this all plays out the way that it's being portrayed right now by authorities, man, it's a super messed up story. Like, it's sad on one level, but it's just jacked up. I've never seen, it's rarely that I've seen things like this happen with a personality that is so clearly in a great spot, you know, in their career, especially post playing career, and you know, to see something like this transpire. I mean, how did you guys react to it?
I'm stunned.
That's the funny thing, is I'm like, I ask people, I'm like, what did you think of that? And people are just like, it seems surreal. Like, it seemed bizarre.
Well, I mean, like, to your point, like, they must have, like, for as quickly as it all went down from the stabbing to him being charged, like, and them, like, being out there talking about how, like, the version of events the victim gave lines up, like, they must have, to your point, they must have something that basically spells the whole thing out.
And when you hear felony, you know it's real business.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, that's the thing, too, like, for someone to stab another person and for the authorities to be like, no, he was in the right.
Right.
You know, basically,
exactly.
Which is the indication you get, right? Like, we're not charging that guy. We're charging another guy who's in the hospital, who's recovering
the
from being stabbed.
Of that guy.
Yeah.
And I saw
the guy that's in the hospital all messed up.
Yeah. And the guy that's in the hospital all messed up. And then even the footage, the, you know, snippets that we've seen of Sanchez walking, which clearly he's, you know, what he's wearing is wet with what is his blood. Yeah, it was just, wow. It's, I don't even know, you know, this is one of those things where we're like, okay, we're going to find out now through whatever the legal process is. And then eventually this is something that will play out over a period of time. We're going to find out how that night unfolded and probably some personal things about Mark Sanchez and his life. If this is all true, if what we're hearing is true, we're going to probably hear some things that are revelatory to us about how this could have happened.
So on the AFC South front, we've talked with you about the Colts, and they continue to just beat up on the Raiders, and they still look great, have all season long to this point. What about the Jags? So the Jags get this dramatic win on Monday Night Football. You've got Liam Cohen and the ride that's been to this point between getting into it with Robert Saleh, the Duval stuff. Like, I thought they were screwed when they hired him between him and Gladstone, and we've talked with you about that. But here they sit at 4-1 with, you know, Lawrence falling down twice on a play, scoring a touchdown the other night. You got Travis Hunter doing his thing out there. What do you make of them, their start to the season, and is this sustainable with Jacksonville in your mind?
Three worst intro press conferences I've seen in the last couple of years. Nick Sirianni, Dan Campbell, Liam Coleman.
It's
right?
Crazy. Yeah.
So maybe when
Adam
you
Gase?
Hire
– Adam Gase?
Okay, Gase. Okay, I wasn't going to go back that far. But you got to – PK, you always got to throw in
something that – Sorry, I mean, Adam Gase with that
let's
stare.
Let's leave Adam Gase in the infamous flying taco video.
Awesome. One of my favorites of all time.
One of the greatest inventions. Still to this day, I think that whoever –
Give that list.
They deserve an Emmy, an Oscar, whatever it is. Whoever
give that list again. Taco.
So Adam Gase undercuts my narrative, but the other three guys, Nick Sirianni, Dan Campbell, and Liam Cohen.
Yeah.
Just, you know, Nick Sirianni looked, I was scared. I'm like, oh my God, this dude's nervous. Like, he is just, this is not a good press conference coming into the league. And then, you know, Dan Campbell and the knee biting thing. And I was like, he's just nuts. Like I'd talked to Dan prior to that ever happening, but I was like, okay, this is some weird metaphor this guy's coming up with. And then obviously the Duval, the weird, just like, are you on some kind of a list? You should not be around people, you know, kind of like, and yet here they are, 4-1, right? And I went through Jacksonville before the season, spent some time with James Gladstone, who is every bit as young as he looks. Was fascinated to kind of hear him talk about sort of how they set up the scouting structure there and just operationally what he wanted to achieve. And it was all very high-minded, very high bar. We're going to change things kind of. And you're like, man, this could go really, really bad. And yet here we are. And by the way, we're here at 4-1 and the Travis Hunter thing has not worked out for them yet.
Yeah.
I would argue that, like, there's no doubt. Like when you look at his contributions defensively and offensively, he's not where I think maybe we thought, or at least I personally thought. I was like, he'll have some kind of a significant impact on one side of the ball pretty quickly. And instead, it's kind of felt middling, you know, both ways. You're like, now I'm staring at him going, you just got to make a commitment here, man. Just move him to offense and figure it out there and then sprinkle in defense, or move him to defense and do the opposite. But I will say this, I knew from Cohen's, you know, reputation coming out of Tampa, I was like, I knew the Jacksonville running game would get better. I didn't realize it would mean Tank Bigsby, you know, going out the door, and Etienne being the guy who, gets life breathing into him and Basil Tootin. But I knew he would get that together. You know, so there's certain aspects of what they've been able to pull off. Now, you know, that said, when you sit there and you stare at it, you go, okay, well, five games, you've been 27 points better than, you know, your opponents at this stage. So it's, the margin is not, it's not like Indianapolis. Indianapolis is dominated in their 4-1 starts. There's just been games where you're like, this is real. The defense has come to play, the running back, the quarterback. I mean, there's multiple things you can point at in Indianapolis and say, this feels sustainable. Jacksonville, I think they still have to prove it in terms of sustainability. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly been a surprise that I didn't necessarily expect. I think there is a ceiling here too that's still attainable in terms of like what they ultimately decide to do with Travis Hunter And I think they're still trying to figure that out. I thought this last week we saw the impact a little bit more on offense than I expected. Brian, I don't know what's going on with Brian Thomas Jr. I tweeted about this or X'd about it during that game where I'm just like, he didn't feel to me like he was coming off the line of scrimmage fast. I don't know if he's bigger, like playing at a higher weight than he did last year or what, but there's just certain elements of, you know, early in the season, I think with him, there was some concern about he had taken some hits and it was like, is he alligator arming it? Is he, you know, shying away from contact? Why is there not this connection between Trevor Lawrence and Brian Thomas Jr. that there was last year? I still think they're working their way through that. But yeah, I mean, the division has not played out really the way that I thought. I would have thought, you're out of your mind, that Indianapolis would be 4-1 through 5, you know, or that Jacksonville, that it would be 8-2 between the, you know, I didn't expect a ton out of Daniel Jones going to, you know, Indianapolis. Even when people were telling me, look, they just need some competent quarterback play, it was hard for me to believe that they would be in this situation. I'd love to go back and listen to our talks about the AFC South before the season, because I guarantee you I probably said some stuff that I would look like total crap right now.
Same.
Based on how I saw the division.
Are the Baltimore Ravens fixable? How much will health help them, or are they broken beyond that?
I don't think it's just health. And I'll tell you, so the Ravens, go back to when they played Detroit. Something happened that game that really concerned me. And I know John Harbaugh has come out and he's supported defensive coordinator Zach Orr. Get it. He's trying to stick with his guy and ride this out. And I definitely health has something to do with it. But there was a play when I was watching the All-22 against Detroit where they had an unbalanced line to the left. Sam Laporta is lined up on the left side of the line. And you're watching the defense, and there's a pre-snap motion where Sam Laporta moves from left to right. So now all of a sudden it's unbalanced from left to unbalanced to the right. When you're watching the Ravens defense, they do nothing. Nothing changes. Absolutely nothing. Gap discipline stays the same. Shading stays the same. Linebackers didn't move. Literally nobody on their team moved when you watched it go from unbalanced line left to unbalanced line right. Which to me, I'm like, okay, they just flip whatever the Lions were doing at the line of scrimmage. Maybe the call from Jared Goff was just to flip it based on what he was seeing from the defense. So he just, whatever, it's a power run left, he moves it to power run right. But what happens when they go unbalanced line right, snap comes, Laporta seals the end, Penei Sewell moves up, wipes out Roquan Smith, and David Montgomery's off to the races. Massive, like, play for the Lions. And I just thought to myself, I'm like, how does that happen with a defense? Like, something was either not communicated, it was coached poorly. Like, it was just a situation where you don't often see that, where a pre-snap motion, literally the defense does nothing. And you see the offensive formation change in a way that was not predicted up until the point when the motion actually happened. So you're like, that's a huge mistake. Now, to me, I'm like, is that coaching? Or is that – because at that time, I mean, defensively, yes, they were missing guys. But, you know, you're like, well, Roquan should have seen that. Right? This is an all-pro level player at his peak. He's, you know, been through a lot of rodeos here. Like, he should have seen this coming. And so I wonder there – that was the moment where I'm like, is this coaching? Like, is something not – getting through between, you know, how Zach Orr is calling the scheme or how it's getting taught and the talent level on the field. But as you said, PK, I mean, they've had massive losses defensively when it comes to the personnel. And, I was working the last couple of days just kind of a, you know, warm-up piece to the trade deadline, and there are definitely teams that are already like, yeah, Baltimore's probably going to be one of those teams that's dealing, you know, or open for business at the deadline. Like, Eric DaCosta is probably going to look at some of these veteran pieces. And so I think, like, it's like Mark Andrews could be a guy who ends up getting called. I wonder if maybe Derrick Henry might be someone that if they, you know, they get into late October and they're still sitting on one win and Lamar's got a hamstring injury that's going to linger, that this could be a team that you start to see them make some moves to change some of the salary outlook, you know, moving forward. But I don't know. I wish I could tell you, you know, definitively that this is a coaching issue or just a health issue. It's probably a little bit of both at this stage. But I can tell you that with Lamar Jackson off the field there, I think there's a chance. I would be shocked if they're not 1-5 after the Rams game. I almost feel like it's baked in at this point that they're going to have to go through, you know, these losses and then try to figure out their bye. You know, you got to bye a couple weeks out, and maybe that's where they try to clean things up. But everybody I've talked to so far is putting Baltimore in the potential trade deadline seller group. And to me, that's a sign that there's not a lot of faith that the Ravens are going to turn this around coming out of October.
All right, last thing. Go ahead, Paul.
I was just going to ask, who are you most scared of? Like in AFC, which we thought was powerhouse, everybody had Bills, everybody had Ravens, people with the Chiefs fading. I don't know how much tarnish that New England game takes off the Bills. Ravens obviously not there. Chiefs, you know, maybe rebound, but are you putting the Colts up there? Do you still think it's the Bills? Who's your favorite in the AFC right now?
Don't you guys feel like there's just so much parity that you're not pinning this? It's hard, right, to pin them.
Yeah, that's the question.
AFC team. Yeah, and I think that plays into the trade deadline. I really truly believe that. That's why when the Terrion Arnold injury happened, I started to, you know, text guys about the Lions or whatever, and you know, there's this like, hey, they could jump on Greg Newsome now rather than wait until the deadline, because right now there's this feeling. I think there's a feeling when you talk to people across the league that's wide open, that hey, it's anybody's call right now. I think there's a suspicion that you know, I know Kansas City's 2-3, but everybody's wary of this idea that, you know, Rice is going to walk through that door after the 6-week suspension, and next thing you know, you have a couple of players between he and Worthy that provide explosives, and that offense could kick it into gear pretty quickly, and then they could be in a position at the trade deadline to make a move. I think this is what makes this a really interesting trade deadline for the league, because I think it's so wide open in the AFC and, by the way, in the NFC. It's not like we're sitting there staring at the Eagles and going, yeah, they're clean.
Right.
It's anything but clean right now for the Eagles, especially with, you know, the passing game. And so I think that's what makes this trade deadline so intriguing, is that you could see some teams that are sitting there going, hey, man, it's if you're Pittsburgh and you're going, every other quarterback in our division's jacked, like completely jacked up. Like, yeah, we're 3-1. We could win this. And so why would we not go shop for another, you know, wide receiver for this offense right now, which I think there's going to be a handful of wide receivers available. Yeah, so I think it's, you know, even Buffalo, when you watch Buffalo, are you sitting there going, yeah, the passing game feels completely resolved?
No.
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. So I you know, PK, you asked me that, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't know who I would pin it on. I mean, you know, I guess I would say Buffalo, because I feel like at the very least it felt like the most complete team, but they've also had moments already in 5 games where you're like, ew, they're vulnerable. There's no question about that. And so I think the trade deadline is going to be a lot of fun this year, because I do think you're going to find some teams that are like, let's see where we're at. And, you know, coming out of October and can we add a piece here or there? And that gives us maybe a little bit of edge over everybody else. I'll just repeat, every time I kick Kansas City or doubt Kansas City, I get it stuck up my rear end. So it's probably 2-3 Chiefs that I think are, you know, a little bit dysfunctional right now and certainly not playing offense the way that we've seen in the past, who maybe getting Rice and then maybe going out. And I still think if they can add the right running back at the deadline, that could really supercharge that offense in a way that they need it.
Charles, great stuff as always, brother. Appreciate you taking time to be with us today. And we will talk to you next week. Good luck to your Tigers on Friday.
Thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Charles Robinson, our guest, joins us every Thursday morning at 8 o'clock here on the program. We'll react to what Charles had to say, continue the conversation on the Titans with PK coming up next. All that ahead, Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5 The Game. DVD with Willie Donick, Derek Mason, and Adam Vingan will be broadcasting live at the all-new Circus Sportsbook Kentucky in the Mint Gaming Hall this Monday. Prior to the Monday night football games, Monday night matchups for the Bills and the Falcons and the Bears taking on the Commanders. Speaking of Circa, Titans and Raiders coming up this weekend. You can hang with Titans fans, including the crew from 102.5 The Game, at the Overhang Bar at Circa in Vegas. Drink specials are included, plus giveaways, including two tickets to the Titans-Raiders game. Go to CircaLasVegas.com for more information. Appreciate Charles Robinson for being with us in the last segment. So, PK, I want to get your thoughts on this. So, I mean, we all know this. Everybody, if you're being honest with yourself, it feels like Brian Callahan's fate is sealed as Titans head coach, right? Like, we've talked about this. It feels like a matter of when, not if, that he's getting fired. So I guess if you're him, you've got a couple of choices there. You can just resign yourself to that and start thinking about life beyond Tennessee, or you can fight like crazy to change that narrative, which I assume that's the route he's trying to take. So, PK, within the scope of realism, which means I'm not talking about them rolling off 9 wins here or anything, within the scope of realism, how does Brian Callahan change that? You know, they got the first win under their belt, takes a little bit of pressure off for the time being. The conversation on him this week has cooled. How do you flip the script? How do you change the narrative if you're Brian Callahan moving forward?
Well, let's go back to the beginning of the season. Let's go back to all those months of the offseason. And when he didn't get fired after the season, what did we say? This was a hugely popular question. We spent hours on it in my time with you guys, and you guys spent a ton of time on it. What does Brian Callahan have to do to get a year 3? Right? And most of us said it's not as much about the record, though he's got to meet some level of improvement in win-loss, as it is about Cam Ward's growth curve. Well, Cam Ward's growth curve just shot up in that one quarter, and we've talked a lot about sustaining that, building off of that. So, excuse me, this is a big game. Does Cam Ward go out and play crappy after that game, or do they show some ability to take what he did in the fourth quarter at Arizona and translate it into a game where, even with Max Crosby probably bearing down on him multiple times, he can make good decisions, find some good throws, throw a variety of different passes to a variety of different targets who can get some effective yards after the catch. And, you know, I don't have the schedule in front of me, but I think we ran through it yesterday. There are winnable games on this schedule, including this one.
Yeah.
He needs to win some of those games. I think most of us said, you know, if he could get to 5-6 wins, there, that could be enough for him to continue. So I think in his head, you know, And all coaches say this, and I tend to believe him. I don't think he's sitting in his office thinking about getting fired. I think he's sitting in his office doing his job and saying, you know, I'm going to do the best job I can and let things fall where they may. But it doesn't do any sense. It doesn't do me any good to just kind of throw in the towel. Now, maybe there'll come a point in December if things trend really badly where there's, you know, he at least privately acknowledges that hopelessness that we were asking about last week. But for right now, especially off of that first win, I think he sees hope and a path. The other thing is he needs not to have any more coaching blunders where he doesn't challenge the right call or mismanages the clock in a bad way or makes a terrible analytical decision, or, you know, can't decide whether he wants to kick a field goal or not.
Well, that's what I was going to bring up, because I agree with everything you said. Like, you know, the Cam Ward growth curve, that's all we talked about in the offseason. And I still think that's the most important thing. However, you know, the information that has changed since then and since those conversations is, well, he has had some absolute blunders out there. And he has come out and not known the rules and all that stuff and defending his guy, all those things that we know that have happened to this point. And he's had play calling stripped away from him. So with those two things kind of in the background, I wonder how much that changes the equation, because as we know, like, you know, taking the play calling stuff away from him came from up top. And that kind of shows you where I think they thought the head coach need to focus his effort. So I hear you on the Cam Ward stuff, and I'm with you. It's the most important thing. But I think those are two pretty huge developments in this thing too, which also changed the math moving forward.
Absolutely changes the math going forward. But he still is the lead dog with regard to Cam during the week and in game outside of calling the plays, in terms of hands-on and lesson plans and technique coaching and all of that. If he's not doing it himself, and he is doing some of it himself, he is coaching the coaches who are coaching Cam as to what the message is. This all is trickled down from Brian Callahan. And so as, you know, whatever Ward does this year, whether he's calling, whether Callahan's calling plays or not, Callahan's going to deserve credit or blame for it. And I think fairly. I mean, the buck stops with him. And so if he's going to save himself, which I think we all think is unlikely, but there is still room and there is still time out of this patience that they seem to be on track to stick with. Cam Ward is the answer to all of these questions.
Well, one more segment with PK coming up next. Take your thoughts. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. Saturday's college football game of the week. South Carolina taking on number 11 LSU at 6:45 on 94.9 The Fan, presented by Twin Peaks Restaurants and Circa Sportsbook Kentucky. Coverage also available on the Game Nashville app and at thegamenashville.com. Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5 The Game. Final segment of the day, Robbie and Rex Road, 102.5 The Game. Robbie Stanley, Paul Kuharski, Ian Safar here with you on this Thursday morning. Let's head to our 102.5 The Game phone line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Welcome in Adam in Portland to the program. Adam, good morning. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, Robbie, man. So, yeah, dude, I've been sick like the last 2 weeks. So I have not listened to sports talk radio or really had to participate in anything in like 2 weeks. So, and I promised you that I wouldn't discuss the Titans, and Ian brought that up as well. So I'm not going to do that. I will say go Preds. I hope we're awesome. The Cardinals are a horrible football team. They should be 32nd in every power ranking. And if we beat the Raiders, they should be 32nd in every power ranking. I've never seen a football game end the way that football game did. I feel like it was a bookie game. Like, that's how it felt so rigged. That's how bad the Cardinals are. So I'll just say that, dude. Like, if you lose to us, you should be 32nd. And I hope the Preds are awesome. Y'all have a good day.
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate it. PK, you know, it is going to be very interesting. You know, not that we care around here about the Arizona Cardinals, but that is the type of loss that can make a team self-destruct. And I am interested to see how they respond to that. Three consecutive walk-off losses for them and one that they just totally gift-wrapped last week.
Yeah, Titans can only play who's on their schedule. So, I mean, you know, they suffered through bad stretch first two games, first three games, it turned out, because the Colts have gotten good. So if they're getting a break now, you know, they'll take it. They're not going to apologize for it. Arizona's bad and getting worse. And that's the kind of game I've written and talked about these before that leaves a scar.
Yeah.
That leaves a scar. And it'll heal, but that's, you know, the scar's going to be there. Organizational scars from games like that become part of a team's psyche and history and all of that. You can change coaches and all of that, but as you look at the franchise and what the franchise is, that's a game that is there. Titans have games like that. Cincinnati playoff game, no matter what the Titans do, who the Titans become, that Cincinnati playoff game, always a piece of – Rex Rudd makes fun of me for talking about DNA. Always a piece of their DNA. Get the number one seed.
Yeah.
One home game away from the AFC championship game, and what do you do? That's a piece of them.
Have you ever been to Allegiant? the giant Roomba coming up this weekend? Is this first time?
I've not been to Allegiant, and I am looking forward to it. I've got a buddy who is Vegas crazy from Southern California, and I'm going to meet he and his wife there Saturday morning. A little nervous about that and the day that we will spend. but Sunday, obviously, all business. I'm looking forward to seeing Allegiant. I understand that there are some commonalities between new Nissan Stadium and similar, the same builder, obviously. So I will be looking for clues there, but always excited to see a new venue, a new building, and, you know, have a little bit of affinity for the Raiders story and everything, considering that I got my first job doing this when the Raiders moved back to the renovated Coliseum in Oakland. And that stadium is now out of business, and the Raiders have moved again. So that's pretty wild from a personal standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, it looks awesome in there. And like you said, some similarities between Allegiant and what the Titans Stadium could have included in it. So looking forward to your report on that. Preds opening up their season tonight. They take on the Columbus Blue Jackets. Fresh start can be a beautiful thing. We'll see how the Predators handle it tonight. PK, you know, an 82-game season, you know, try to avoid going 0-5, digging yourself in a hole. That'd be a nice start from the Preds. Get a win tonight.
Yeah, and, you know, they've got room here more in the fall than usual, I think, just given how bad the Titans are to see the city's attention in a way they usually don't get to in the fall. So go grab that.
Yeah, no question about it. Preds in action tonight, 7 o'clock puck drop. Pregame at 6 o'clock here on 102.5 The Game. PK, thank you for being with us, brother. My condolences to your Yankees, but there's always next year, my friend.
Oh, I've got a family that still alive and anxious to see what happens tonight. So I will try to jump on their train. Not the same by any means. Don't block a box out there. Be sure to lock your locks. And we know who's not blocking the boxes. People with ducks on their
sport. Get the ducks and the Jeeps off the road. That does it for us today. Next man up with Jake Lyman coming up next. You're listening to 102.5 The Game.